This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Few would argue with the notion that knowing our past makes for a solid foundation to grow from, and understanding our past is, in part, the driving force behind the Wisconsin History Tour, sharing Wisconsin's stories one community at a time. It's a year-long initiative by the Wisconsin Historical Society, and the tour has landed in La Crosse for the month of November. The History Tour has two major components to it. The first is a traveling exhibit that shares a sampling of state history and stories that the Society has been gathering since its founding in 1846. This exhibit is on display through November 26th at the Weber Center for the Performing Arts in downtown La Crosse. The other part of the tour focuses on bringing authors, genealogists, architects, and storytellers together to present a series of special programs. Those are taking place this week, having kicked off with a timely day-long salute to Wisconsin veterans' history on Veterans Day. Other highlights range from celebrated rural historian Jerry Apps, who shares farm stories, to genealogy workshops, and, not surprisingly, to a couple programs related to the Mississippi River. Wisconsin Historical Society underwater archaeologist Tamara Thompson is among those presenting this week. She talked with WPR's John Gatto about the tour and specifically her presentation on exploring our inland waterways, including remnants of the riverboat, the War Eagle, sitting on a river bottom just outside of La Crosse. She says it's all part of telling our story.
Well, the Wisconsin History Tour is really a greater outreach initiative by the Wisconsin Historical Society to really get some of the great stories that we've collected over the years out into the communities and to work with the local historical societies to help share the local history through speakers and workshops and various events, bringing in book writers to various communities throughout Wisconsin.
How is it that it's furthering the Society's mission? I mean, I guess we think of the Society as being based in Madison and not so much outstate, if you will.
We have a vast collection that's here in Madison. We have museums here, but we also have many historic sites that are out around the state, too. And it's really just kind of connecting all of the dots and gathering stories, too, that we may not know of to be able to share with other people throughout the state.
What does the tour mean to the residents of Wisconsin or to those who participate in the exhibition?
Well, I can share from my experience. I was part of the Ephraim tour and gave a presentation on the local shipwrecks. And we drew in just such a large crowd there. And people had all sorts of stories to share from, like, their maritime past. That's what I do is maritime history specifically. And then when I shared stories that I knew, we got a lot of feedback from people that they just didn't know that part of their history, and they were really, really happy to have had us there to share it.
And I have to believe there's a lot of great stories related to maritime events on the Great Lakes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I spend most of my time actually on the Great Lakes, but it's important to remember that the Great Lakes were part of a greater waterway that connected really all of us here in Wisconsin or the immigration here in Wisconsin back to the East Coast. So it allowed us to get products back to the large eastern cities, and the riverways connected to the lakes and all the way back out to the East Coast.
We think of diving in the Great Lakes. We don't necessarily think of diving for history in the rivers, though.
Well, I think part of the program we're having is there's a diver that's coming in that's going to speak about pearling in the Mississippi River, which I think will be very interesting. I don't know a whole lot about that part of the history, but I know that it was a very, very big industry. And he had written an article for the Wisconsin Magazine of History. So I'm pretty excited to find out about a little bit about that. And then we're talking about the river history as far as shipwrecks that are located in the Mississippi and in various waterways around the state.
Just before we talk about some of the specifics related to the Mississippi River and some of its, the War Eagle and perhaps other sunken ship stories,
sure.
Talk a little bit about the importance, the value of the river to Wisconsin historically, specifically perhaps to the La Crosse area. But what's the significance really of the Mississippi?
The Mississippi River is very significant. Not only does it form our border, but it actually – was a pathway to get immigrants here and to get products out of Wisconsin. We see this as early as the fur trade in Wisconsin, and then we can see transport of goods, bringing them down the Mississippi into the Gulf to be transported out of the country into other portions of the world. But we also see, you know, if we think back early to the fur trade days, you think of paddle and portage and people hauling goods up into the Great Lakes, actually, from the Mississippi River, and being able to connect out to the eastern ports that way.
And can you take it a step further back to the Native Americans?
Oh, certainly. You know, the riverways were very important to the natives. In fact, a lot of these passageway or these riverways were taking people from village to village, would allow them to communicate and to share goods. We also know about early Native American trade that happened along the various riverways of the state. And then when we do look to the fur trade and early settler movement, most of those were following Native American routes. And so we see a lot of these same routes used and utilized, and some of the portages used and utilized to bring immigrants to the area and then also to bring goods out.
As an underwater archaeologist, what are you looking for? What do you typically find? I mean, if we're digging in a gravel pit, we find bones and tools and things like that. What do you find in the waterways?
Well, my expertise really is working with the shipwrecks of the state. So I know that our office has done work on inundated fur trade sites and the such, but that was before my time and I wasn't involved with it. So what we look at is we sort of forensically look at these ships on the bottom. Locating them is really the first step. And then we look at the remains that are down there. So have they burned? What's remaining? They really act as a time capsule of items that went down with the ship. So if the ship went down in the 1860s, you'll see things that the passengers or the crew or if it was a ship carrying trade goods into an area, you know, what goods would have been brought into a Western settlement and what a frontier city might have with them.
Tamara Thompson is the Wisconsin Historical Society's underwater archaeologist. She's leading one of several community discussions this week in La Crosse in conjunction with the Wisconsin History Tour, sharing Wisconsin's stories one community at a time on exhibit through November 26th at the Weber Center in downtown La Crosse. And you're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Being an underwater archaeologist is not something that many of us would aspire to. What led you to this? Is it the interest in history? Is it interest in water?
Well, I sort of come to it in a non-conventional way. Most people that study to be an underwater archaeologist go to school for it. They either go to school for archaeology or they specifically go to school for maritime archaeology. I have a master's in genetics. When I got out of school, I was working for the geology and geophysics department here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I was working in the submerged lead mines in the southwestern part of the state. And because of my work underwater, I was asked to come and volunteer for the Historical Society. So for several years, I volunteered on projects, and eventually they asked me if I would like to work and continue doing some outreach projects with them. And until someone better came along, and either they haven't found anything better or anyone better, or I've kind of been here for 11 years.
So part of your success then is that you're making underwater history accessible and interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's part of my job, really, is to not just go there and look at what's down there, but to be able to share it with people who may not go. Either they aren't comfortable on the water, or they don't boat or kayak, or they're not divers. I mean, some of the projects we do are in very, very shallow water, and I get questions like, oh, I don't look at these shipwrecks because I'm not a diver, or I don't snorkel, or I don't like the water. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are very accessible. They either make up the shoreline, they're part of like a retaining wall that's there, or they might be up on a beach, and you'll see these pieces of wood, and you'll say, well, I wonder what that is, and it's actually a shipwreck, and it'll have a whole story, a whole history behind it.
Well, then tell us a little bit about the War Eagle.
Sure. It's in the Black River, and it's just upstream from Riverside Park. It's in only about 15 feet of water, and it sank on the 15th of May, 1870, and it was involved in a fire. She had come into port on the night of the 14th of May and dropped off her passengers at the city landing, right, mm-hmm. at the foot of State and Front Street, mm-hmm. and then she proceeded up to the railroad depot. The Milwaukee Road Depot was there on the Black River, and these were really important places for the connection between the railway and the rivers, and so they were going to take on passengers that night, and so they proceeded up and waited for the passengers to come aboard. They came in on the midnight train from Milwaukee, and then they were going to get passage up to St. Paul. And so many of the people got aboard, and the products were loaded, and the freight was loaded, and they went to sleep. But as they were loading some of the freight aboard, it was noticed that one of the barrels of non-explosive petroleum fluid, which is basically a lamp oil, was leaking. And the captain ordered the ship's carpenter to tighten the barrel so that it wouldn't stop leaking. And although it wasn't explosive, it was very flammable. And so while he was fixing the barrel, his lamp fell over and set the ship on fire. Wow. He kicked the barrel overboard, but there had been a barge that was pulled up next to it, and then the barge caught fire. And so they're not certain how many people were aboard the ship when the fire broke out. Unfortunately, the passenger list was lost in the fire, but the War Eagle was lost. Two other steamers that were pulled up to the Milwaukee Road Depot were heavily damaged. The barge was lost as well and sank to the bottom. They think there's some dispute as to the numbers, whether it was 5 or 7 people that were lost in the tragedy. But the War Eagle sank to the bottom and was pretty much left untouched until the 1930s. I think probably because of the damage that also occurred to many of the buildings on the property and the loss of the trains mm-hmm. and the warehouses and things that they just didn't worry too much about bringing the ship up, and so it was just kind of forgotten about. It wasn't until about 1931 there was a very low water level in the Mississippi, and then that exposed the upper deck of the War Eagle, and many people went and salvaged some of the items that were aboard. So there was lots of china and silverware and those type of things that went into private collections. So many of the collections, I understand, are on display at the Riverside Museum. And the story can be shared right there.
The locks and the dams, of course, arrived, you know, after that. I mean, initially, that would have been a whole different water scene mm-hmm. than it is today. Today, yeah. You stand at Riverside Park, and if you're looking north, you see where the main channel of the Mississippi veers off to the northwest, if you will, and the Black goes off to the kind of to the north northeast, mm-hmm. And the La Crosse River kind of veers off then to the east as well. But so we're talking about north of that spot. In the Black River,
yes,
And since the locks and the dams have changed the water, what's the status of the War Eagle now? Is it still just below the surface, or what's the story?
Yeah, it's in about 15 feet of water right now.
It is, okay.
We know this because our office was called on around 2000 to take a look at the remains of the War Eagle. Actually, the owners of the property were trying to remove some of the pilings that went into the dock there. I believe it's the Standard Oil Company. Mm. And it was of some concern as they were removing the pilings that they would do damage to the shipwreck that was in the area, so they were required to hire a diver and someone with archaeological experience to come in and look at the site and make sure that no additional damage to the shipwreck would be caused. So divers from our office went in and took a look at that, and they were able to identify the keel of the War Eagle, and a large section, a little over 100 feet, and then two smaller sections, all in total around just short of 200 feet of ship was determined to be found. Plus, many artifacts still remained there. They found remnants or shards of china, square nails, and other items that were believed to be contributed to the War Eagle. There was unprocessed lead, which the War Eagle supposedly was carrying. And so it was believed that hull that was there was indeed the War Eagle. And what's interesting is that when the piling was put in, it was actually put in through a piece of the hull of War Eagle. So Wow. It was right there.
So it's kind of anchored there for quite a long time.
Yeah. So.
Is it still an accessible artifact for people to take in? The water itself is fairly murky, and I have to believe is fairly difficult even for divers to fully appreciate.
It's not encouraged to go to that particular site just for, diving in the river requires a lot of expertise, but the site is protected, so artifact collecting is not available on that particular on any shipwrecks in the state of Wisconsin. So that's discouraged as well. So like I said, it's a very, very difficult place to dive, and the effort for what you're able to see is probably not the best ratio. Mm-hmm. So I would probably suggest to people who are interested in going to visit the site, I'd probably send them to maybe a couple different places where it'll be a little more pleasurable, easier diving, and they'll be able to see a little better.
War Eagle itself.
Not for the War Eagle itself, but I would send them to a different shipwreck if shipwrecks are something that's interesting to them.
Yeah, well, and I was just going to ask, this is one that we hear about, not every day, of course, but are there other shipwrecks that are in this stretch of the Mississippi or its contributing waters?
Oh, certainly. There's quite a few stories of shipwrecks on the Mississippi. Just south of La Crosse, off of Bad Axe Island, there was a fire that took place aboard a steamboat called the JS, which took place on the 25th of June, 1910. There were about 1,000 people aboard on the excursion vessel, and they had left La Crosse. They were heading to Lansing, Iowa, and they detected the fire within 2 minutes. The captain had put them ashore next to Bad Axe Island and let everyone off. And really, there were only two casualties because of his quick response. One was a man that they had tied up in the hold. So that's kind of he was intoxicated and very disruptive.
Boy.
And so they had detained him. And then unfortunately, one other man was burned as well. So and that is, the remains of that that ship are only 300 feet from shore. So in the
and how deep?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the depth of the water is there. It's relatively shallow.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. We're talking with Tamara Thompson. She's an underwater archaeologist, in fact, the underwater archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society. On the occasion of the Society's Wisconsin History Tour, Sharing Wisconsin's Stories One Community at a Time, it's on exhibit this month in La Crosse. So, the War Eagle is one example. You just mentioned another one off the Bad Axe River area there. You, as the diver, you and others will retrieve artifacts and take pictures and all of this, and you take it back to the Historical Society where somebody somehow begins to put together the stories. How does that happen?
We don't do a lot of artifact recovery these days. It was done in the early history of our program, but to come up with long-term storage, like forever, for an artifact tends to be quite expensive. Also, stabilization of articles which have been in the water, especially wooden objects, is quite costly. And preserving them and stabilizing them is just quite an effort. And so our program really works with the National Register of Historic Places office or the State Register of Historic Places office at Wisconsin Historical Society. So what we do is we evaluate the sites for listing on the National Register of Historic Places, which provides them a federal level of protection against looting or damage. And then we just, in doing so, we end up doing an in-depth history on the various wrecks. We also are required to do a report on what the site looks like the current condition of it, and give as much detail as we can, detailed measurements and explanation of what the bottom looks like around the site and what artifacts remain present. And then those histories are put up online. We share them through field reports. We also make a concerted effort to get out into the community. We do almost 30 public outreach presentations a winter, trying to share the various stories of the shipwrecks of Wisconsin.
So how many more shipwrecks are there in the Mississippi that still need to be explored?
Well, in the mid-90s, folks that were in our office went through and they did a literature search. So they went through and looked at all of the various newspapers up and down the river to catalog all of the losses. So if someone's boat caught fire or there was an accident where there was a boiler explosion or, even if it was a mishap and something happened, all of this was cataloged out. And so I can't say for certain how many shipwrecks remain on Wisconsin's side of the river, but we know sort of a number that gets thrown out there is that there are 500 shipwrecks that were lost in the Mississippi River.
So all of Mississippi.
That's all along the Mississippi. So we know of all Wisconsin shipwrecks that there are 750 historic losses, which is includes the Great Lakes, our side of Lake Michigan, all the way out to the state line. Our little portion of Lake Superior and all of the inland waterways. So the 750 total in losses in Wisconsin. When they went through and cataloged all of these, then they tried to ground truth them. They tried to go out to the places where these reported losses were. And they had difficulty, even with like side scan sonar, finding evidence of many of the wrecks. And so either they were salvaged, and a lot of times you see reference to, a ship going down and then having, the boilers or the engines or pieces of the hull removed and reused in other ships. And so there's a lot of work to be done yet to see what actually is there. But there wasn't a whole lot of evidence that there was much left, if there was. The War Eagle is an exception. There's quite a bit left of the War Eagle, as I understand, and many artifacts associated with it. But the other wrecks that are lost in the various sloughs along the river too, through flood and ice and other movement of the bottom, and salvage, there's very little remaining of them.
And with all that fascinating history attracting people, what's the future hold?
You know, we haven't spent an awful lot of time in my recent history with the Historical Society along the Mississippi. And I think it's mostly because of funding. We're 90% grant funded. And so the funding sources for us really do come from like University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, which focuses on Great Lakes resources.
Right.
And so it's been kind of difficult for us. I mean, the director of the Historical Society actually put out a request to look at Civil War related sites. And really, you know, it's very hard to come up with a submerged cultural site that has to do with the Civil War in Wisconsin. So I thought War Eagle. The War Eagle is protected right now. It's it has a determination of eligibility to the National Register of Historic Places, which was done in the 70s. So it's been one of our first shipwrecks that was protected. And but to be able to list that on the National Register would take a full archaeological survey. And so I started looking for funding for that. And the funding sources are very limited. So but I'm still on the case. I'm still trying to find someone interested in funding that or some organization or foundation. To be able to do a full survey to give the War Eagle what she deserves.
Kind of amazing that hasn't happened up to this point with something that appears to be a fairly unique relic of the
Mississippi.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So and I mean it does have just a very incidental Civil War history to it, but there is a connection. I mean, she was taking troops from Fort Snelling down to the confluence of the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers quite frequently, and she did experience one casualty. She was struck by a stray bullet, which hit her smokestack in 1862, and so therefore we can list her in service for the Civil War.
Tamara Thompson is the Wisconsin Historical Society's underwater archaeologist. She's leading one of several community discussions this week in La Crosse in conjunction with the Wisconsin History Tour, sharing Wisconsin stories one community at a time. It's on exhibit through November 26th at the Weber Center in downtown La Crosse. Links to additional information about the tour and this week's programs in La Crosse can be found on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Coming up, diversity in our museums. Do our stories and exhibitions accurately reflect the diverse populations and ideas from our past? Chris Taylor from the Minnesota Historical Society shares his thoughts when we continue. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCullum. To hear audio archives of today's show and other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. When you visit a museum, what do you see? Most likely an artifact from centuries ago, a painting by a modern master, or an audiovisual installation created by a student. But do these collections represent the makeup of our increasingly diverse society? Our guest today says many museums need to step outside of their comfort zones and incorporate more diversity, not only into the art and history on display, but also in their leadership roles. Chris Taylor is the head of inclusion and community engagement at the Minnesota Historical Society. He's recently visited the UW La Crosse campus. So, Chris, I want to ask, is it fair to say that many museums do lack diversity, and how so?
Yeah, I think the field as a whole is evolving. We're not quite there yet, and there's a number of issues for that. Part of it is getting college students prepared and interested in museums. But, you know, the history and the evolution of museums, particularly in America, were elite institutions for the elite part of society. And so a lot of the collections, which are, in essence, the heart of museums, were collected for a sense of showing power of American museums and authority and things of that nature. And so we're starting to see with different demographic shifts within the country that museums need to shift their cultures as well to be more representative of society.
You know, are you looking at the art itself, maybe created by people of different backgrounds? Are you talking about the subjects represented in the art? All of the above, maybe?
I think it's a little bit of all of the above. When we look at collections, whose stuff are we collecting is a big piece of that. Speaking for my institution, we're well aware that we have gaps within our collection, and that can be for a number of reasons. But, you know, without certain objects collected, certain stories are hard to represent. And so I think that that's something where museums across the board need to do a better job. I think there are certain museums, tribal and ethnic museums or specialty museums, that can do or have done a better job over time. But for the mainstream kind of museum field, it's been difficult.
So you said that there are some gaps within Minnesota Historical Society's collection. Mm-hmm. Where are those gaps?
Well, one that I'm aware of is, you know, with our Latino collection. Mm. I had a group in the other day from a community on our west side of St. Paul, which is known as District del Sol. It's historically been a Latino community. And, you know, we just don't have a lot of the material culture. And I don't know if that's because it's an issue of trust. You know, you don't want to give your stuff to people who you don't trust. It might be an issue of awareness and how we preserve things. It might be more of a cultural issue where they tend to pass their stuff on to the next generation. And so I'm not 100% sure why that is. You know, we have photos. We have oral histories. But the material objects is where I think we can see the gap.
So there might be some people listening who think, well, I go to fill-in-the-blank museum, and I know that they have this great Japanese art collection, or I can see that they have these Native American tools on display that were used centuries ago. I feel like the museum I'm going to is diverse, but obviously there are some deeper issues at play.
A lot of historical collecting practices were not the most ethical in nature, nor were these things collected to tell particular stories. They were collected with this kind of exoticism in mind, you know, the exotic other culture and that type of thing. Particularly American Indian collections, you know, there is this idea that American Indian culture was vanishing, and so put it in a museum and let's preserve it that way. And so it's interesting because, you know, one of the programs I run at Minnesota Historical Society, we were just having a conversation with my students around collections the other day. And it is about telling stories, but we're also seeing collections being used by people from those particular cultures to support efforts of cultural revitalization. And so if a tradition in a culture in a particular area maybe has died out, if a museum has, whether it's baskets or beadwork or whatever it might be, that people can come in and study to bring back to their communities. And so we've got an artist in residence program where that's a big focus of that artist coming in to study the historical traditions of their communities or their cultures so that they can either revitalize those traditions or to somehow preserve them and carry them on today, which is phenomenal. I don't think when a lot of these things were collected, that was the purpose in mind. And so it just shows kind of the evolution of the mindset. We can't deny where we've been as museums, but I think we can start to be more forward-looking.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Chris Taylor. He's the head of inclusion and community engagement at the Minnesota Historical Society. I want to talk about the idea of maybe permanent collections and diversifying permanent collections versus bringing in those special collections that, you know, rotate in and out on an annual basis. I'm sure there are some diversity issues at play there.
Yes, and I think, you know, with the permanent collection, you know, I don't know that exhibition is the, I guess for me, isn't the big kind of win or benefit from those. it's really being able to be true to your mission. For us, you know, our mission is using the power of history to transform lives. And I think for us to make sure that those lives are the lives of all Minnesotans, we need to start thinking about how we're collecting the evidence of these people and thinking how what we're doing now will impact Minnesotans 100 years from now. You know, one of the trends that has been around for a while with collecting is the idea of contemporary collecting, mm-hmm. which is almost like speculation because you're trying to figure out what should we collect now. You know, so there's some of that, and I think we do some of that at Minnesota Historical Society. It's hard, though, because there's kind of the what we should do, and we all feel that, but then there's the what we can do, and that can be determined by space issues. Mm. That could be determined by the nature of our relationships with various communities. That could be determined completely by luck, being in the right place at the right time. I think in a lot of ways our collections department is very forward-thinking. You know, we've looked at our NAGPRA policy, which is our repatriation policy, and that's gone from really a document grounded in what is the legal to err more towards the side of what is the ethical, which is something that I'm really proud of with our institution. It's one of those things where we've got to keep pushing forward, right? We can't ever become complacent like, well, you know, we changed our NAGPRA policy, so that's great. You know, this we're there. You know, and museums have been around in America since 1789 or so, and, you know, we're going to be around for a long time. So we've got time to change, but I think it's just making sure that we're thinking about these issues intentionally. You know, and I think that that's where we're starting to see a lot of different mindsets or trends. You know, our kind of quasi-regulatory board, the American Alliance of Museums, just recently, I'd say within the last 5 to 6 months, kind of published their definitions of what diversity and inclusion are related to museums. And I think hopefully for a lot of museums, it's just a nice, easy adoption to we're going to kind of fall under the umbrella of AAM.
Can you share the definition?
Diversity is difference. And so difference can be a lot of different things, age, gender, race, ethnicity, you know, sexual orientation. It could also be education. It could be socioeconomic. There's a lot of different ways. But essentially, it's this idea of difference. Inclusion boils down to more how we as an institution will leverage the benefits of diversity and being able to recognize that, and how does that start to influence what we can do as a museum. By them defining it, I think it does a couple of things. I think it clarifies what diversity and inclusion is for museums, but it also sends a message that this is going to be something that we're starting to internalize as the AAM, which I'm hoping will start to influence their accreditation process and things of that nature. Because once you start to solidify it or tie it to those formal structures, it doesn't become a choice of if we can or if we can't, or, you know, it takes away some of, I think, the easy barriers of time and things of that nature. It just becomes something that you have to do, which is phenomenal. You know, and they're thinking about staff within AAM and how do they really make this an intentional strategy. And that's kind of where we've decided to go at MNHS as well, is really making sure that this is something that isn't tacked on to other people's jobs. It's not something that we do when we can, when we have time or resources or whatever, but this is something that we're dedicated to doing. It's going to push us out of our comfort zone, but that's a good thing.
Before, you mentioned how, you know, some museums are thinking differently, especially when it comes to modern acquisitions. Mm-hmm. How do you think about what to really save and preserve in modern times? And especially when you are thinking, and people are thinking more about saving things from diverse cultures.
Mm-hmm. I think part of what needs to happen is that that no longer necessarily becomes our call as museums. I think by trying to build relationships with communities and understanding what's important within their communities, I think will give us kind of our direction on where we should be collecting these. And, you know, I don't know that we necessarily need to be the repository for every group's stuff or collections mm-hmm. or material culture. I just, you know, I think that's part of the question as well. We have a Somali museum that just recently started in the Twin Cities. I think we're the second largest urban Somali population. And so there's a museum that just started. To me, that's the more logical place. But how do we work in partnership to incorporate that museum or to work in partnership with that museum so that we can have a presence within our museum as well? So maybe that's working with objects on loan or working in partnership where, you know, they've got an exhibit that ties into an exhibit that we have, or maybe it's something where we can do an oral history project that can benefit that museum. One message that can come from us is that it's important to preserve culture. And I think, you know, different cultures do it in different ways, and it's not always making sure stuff winds up being preserved in a museum. But working in partnership with those communities, it helps us understand how to meet the needs of those communities better. If it's something where we shouldn't have stuff in the collection, we can find that out. And I think we need to be okay with that and get away from that more traditional mindset of, nope, we got to put it in the collection. We got to save it and we got to catalog it and we got to. But I also think, too, you know, hopefully what we can do is show how objects that have been taken care of can benefit now a community or a culture that, like I was saying before, maybe some of their traditions have gone away or something like that. So there is a lot to say for the importance of preserving these things. It's just a matter of how and what's the best way to do that.
So when you think 10, 20, 100 years down the line and you think about museums becoming more diverse and whatnot, what sort of impact do you think that will have on those generations as they live and experience these more diverse museums?
Automatically, and I guess this is more of my perception and nothing that I've researched or can document, but it seems to me that more of a sense of pride in one's community and one's culture. You know, when you see yourself reflected within an institution like a museum, to me, that's something that can instill pride. And maybe that's my perception. Maybe that's not everybody's goal in life. But, you know, but I also think, too, you know, museums are educational institutions. And I don't think the benefit is just for that community alone. It's for communities across, you know, my new department is essentially diversity and inclusion work. But one of the big things that we're trying to make sure that we do is that we're as focused on non-diverse people and their education about different cultures, because the more everybody's kind of cultural awareness increases, the better off everybody's going to be. And so I feel like just by diversifying what museums have or the stories that they can tell, it puts everybody on more of an equal footing, and it's no longer this dominant narrative, but it's a narrative for everybody.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Chris Taylor. He's head of inclusion and community engagement at the Minnesota Historical Society. What seems to be another focus of your work is really getting museums to think about not only diversifying their collections, but their leadership and staff positions. Can you talk about the state of diversity within museum figureheads?
Yeah, well, you know, across the museum field in general, it's about an 8% diversity within the field. When you look at national population demographics now, but I think even more importantly, trends over the next 20 years, we're really in a situation where we've got a certain sector of society telling stories that are supposed to be inclusive for everybody else. You know, and I think for me, you know, it's not realistic that that percentage is going to change overnight. But I think what we need to do is we need to be thinking about ways to cultivate that next generation of museum professionals. Particularly, you look at now with the millennial generation, it's the most diverse generation in history. So as we start to cultivate, you know, some of the college students and emerging professionals and getting museum careers on their radars and hopefully attracting them to the museum field, that will help to diversify. But, you know, we're really looking at, and I'll speak particular to my museum, looking at transferring corporate practices over to kind of our practices within the museum. And it's not an exact correlation, but, you know, one of the areas within my new department that we're looking at is what we're calling talent management. So it's recruitment and retention of staff. But I also think, too, more importantly, before we can recruit more diversity, we need to be prepared to support more diversity, which comes down more to our organizational culture. And so we're working with measuring where we're at with our cultural competence, and we're also going to be working with a lot of learning and development and professional kind of staff trainings and things like that for the staff that we do have to become more inclusive. And, you know, it's great. I did a lot of research within my organization over the summer, and it's not about a lack of desire. Everybody's very excited to become more inclusive. I don't think it's just kind of instinctive to do that. And when I think you don't have a background where you've grown up in a culture of difference, it's very hard for you to navigate now within cultures of difference, and what are those tools that we need to provide?
I'm curious what your thoughts are on access to museums, whether it's, you know, proximity and getting there via public transportation, or, you know, someone who has low income. Some museums cost a lot of money to get into. So are you working with institutions, or is this something that's that you're just thinking about when it comes to being more inclusive for people to access different museums?
You know, I think a lot of museums are looking at that access question. And for me, I think economics is one conversation that we can have. But I would also say that within most groups, you've got different strata of economic, you know, ability as well, right? And so even when we're not getting our communities that we would define as diverse communities, we're not getting those people even representative to the fact that they would have some sort of economic stability in their community. You know, I think our visitorship is about 8% or so. Part of that might be economics, but I don't think that's the whole answer. I think part of it is
like, is there like a comfort level associated with it?
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. Museums have always been kind of imposing. Museums have always been these elite, like high culture type organizations, and that's the reputation or the stigma that we have. But also too, you know, are we truly representing everybody within our programs and our offerings and how we do the work, right? If we don't show that we value everybody across the board, I don't know that we're going to get everybody across the board that wants to come to us. And I don't think that it's something where I shouldn't say value, because I think within my organization, I can speak for the fact that we do value difference within our organization. But I think because of the historic kind of past that we have as a museum, it becomes tough, right? And so now it's incumbent upon us, I feel, to work even harder to engage these communities, right? And we need to do that intentionally. We can't just say it's business as usual, because business as usual is going to continue to get us the results that we've gotten. So we need to change some things that we're doing. And if that means that we need to place a higher emphasis on engaging communities that have historically been underengaged, we need to do that and put resources and effort into doing that. You know, and I think that's going to mean that we have to get outside of our museum building to do this, right? We need to be out in communities.
Bring the museum to them.
Absolutely. I'm not sure 100% what that looks like. You know, mm-hmm. we're thinking about, so there's four areas in my new department. I talked a little bit about like training and development and talent management. The other two are more external. They're programs, because by nature we do programs, but it's also community relationship building. So we're going to have staff that are dedicated to figuring out what those strategies are. And it doesn't, you know, for us having a department that is looking in these four areas, it doesn't absolve the rest of the historical society for doing work around diversity and inclusion. The best analogy I've been able to come up with is we're akin to like an IT department, to where IT supports technology throughout the entire institution. We're going to support diversity and inclusion work across the society. So we can partner internally with various departments. We can provide advice. We can build contacts and networks within communities that can be utilized by other people in the organization. It's that intentionality.
Chris Taylor is head of inclusion and community engagement with the Minnesota Historical Society. We were talking about the issue of increasing diversity in museums. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.